Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Hey, folks. Welcome back to the show. Today is June 13th. Coming up is my interview with Daniel Amadori. Dan's an entrepreneur, an investor, and the president of FutureMoneyTrends.com. We're going to be discussing his experience getting involved with investing in entrepreneurship from a very early age. He put himself through a self-directed financial education while he was in middle school, which is amazing to me. All I can remember from middle school is like riding around on a bus with a frowny face. Seems like that's all I did. We'll also talk about how that financial education led him to the real estate market in the 20-aughts at just the right time, I would say. Then we'll move on to discussing his experience venturing in 2008 into a fairly new media platform called YouTube. His early financial education combined with several years of experience in real estate investing motivated him to start making videos warning about impending doom in the financial world. It was around the time Bear Stearns went under, and this was a good 6 months before the real global panic began with the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy in September. And apparently that spring, there were a lot of really bright people who saw the writing on the wall, who were trying to deliver warnings, and many of them felt like they had no place to go, but Dan found a place. And I think that makes for a really cool story, especially considering, you know, what YouTube became. But 10 years ago, my goodness, it was so unorthodox to sit alone in a room by yourself and talk into a camera. It's like the kind of thing Osama bin Laden was doing. But Dan saw the potential in that platform. He was one of the first Google partners, one of the first people to monetize a YouTube channel. And he's still at it today with Future Money Trends. Also on the show today, Dan is going to discuss the whys and hows of home education for his own three children, along with his wife, who is a former public school teacher. And you know what? More stuff coming soon. I just had a great discussion with Kylan Ginger. He is the creator of a website called SuccessfulDropout.com, and he has a podcast where he interviews entrepreneurs, mostly in their 20s and their 30s, who left high school or college before they were supposed to. And then they talk about all the exciting things that happen next. Great conversation. I'll try to get that to you by the end of the week. Thanks for listening, everybody, and take care. My guest today is Dan Amadori. He's an entrepreneur, investor, the president of FutureMoneyTrends.com, and I should also add YouTube pioneer to that.
I was, I don't make a big deal about it, but I was one of the first people to be paid by Google.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So why don't we start the story before that point? I'm very interested in people that get started at a very young age. So I've heard different aspects of your story before. I know you, and I've heard you say this in other interviews, that you started to develop an interest in personal finance and you were researching it like when you were in middle school.
Yeah, I've always been fascinated. I was always an entrepreneur when I was a kid, whether it was undercutting the teacher by selling pencils for 9 cents when she sold them for 10, getting in trouble, or coming across the Robert Kiyosaki book, How to Be Rich and Happy, Don't Go to School. It was his first book. It was prior to Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And then, of course, later on, I read his book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and all those series. So even as a teenager and a child, I was always fascinated with the idea that you could make money, and it was something I never was fascinated with materialism. It was just the idea of making money was more of a game to me, and I always enjoyed allocating money and investing money. And the Rich Dad Poor Dad book, of course, was really kind of summarized and gave me a direction. Like, I always felt a defiance towards the idea of a 401k, the idea of a job, the idea of having to be go to school for 10 years or 8 years or something. Mm-hmm. And then I read that book, and then I was like, oh, okay, here's this guy who's kind of all those feelings that I had, and he put it into words. So I definitely recommend that book to people, the Rich Dad Poor Dad book.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think I read it maybe 12 years ago, and it definitely changed my thinking. I'm embarrassed to admit I've never heard of the book before that. If you want, what was it called?
I'm almost certain the title is Want to Be Rich and Happy, Don't Go to School. And that is his very first book. That book came out probably 3, 4, 5 years before the Rich Dad Poor Dad series came out.
Yeah, and this is, if you look at the history and the function of the public school system in this country and many other Western countries around the world, this is about, forming in people obedience, conformity, and those things produce a kind of apathy towards, projecting some vision into the world or being entrepreneurial. People leave school looking to be employees and really not, and there's not anything automatically wrong with being an employee. I have lots of friends who have great jobs and they get a lot of satisfaction from their work. But I know a lot more people who don't enjoy, such things. So, yeah, I mean, school prepares us to go in that direction. And that was one of Kiyosaki, looking at his wealth and his success. He was the first person, I think for me, maybe around 2004, 2005, that started to confirm a lot of the suspicions I had about the education system. So was he like that turning point for you as well?
Sure, because there was really nobody to guide me. There was nobody to confirm with what I agree. I do have some memories, and when I learned about the 401k in high school, they would talk about it, and they're kind of teaching you how to write a check, and they'd go over that thing. And I'll never forget the teacher making the case that the reason you wanted this 401k was because that when you retire, you'll be in the lowest tax bracket. And even as a child, I was probably 14 or 15, I'll never forget thinking to myself, I hope I'm in the highest tax bracket when I'm 65 years old. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be in the lowest tax bracket because that means I'm poor. So, I would watch all these adults, in my life go to work, and they'd be in traffic or they'd be gone all day from 4 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Yeah.
And I just never got it. I was like, I don't want to do that. But of course, when you reject that, there at that time, there at least in my world, there really wasn't an alternative. Because higher education did work for people who graduated in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and even the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a religion in the 90s when I was in high school. You absolutely had to go to college because that paper guaranteed you success. But just like retirement itself is an experiment, something that really was created only in the last 50 to 75 years, so was higher education. And higher education is now diluted, and with technology and the internet, there's really no reason for it unless you need some sort of government mandated license. I don't know why there's such this obligation that you have to go get a degree. I kind of like what Steve Jobs said, where he was going to college as a drop in, and he would just drop into the classes that he wanted to go to.
Right.
Now today you have the internet. You don't even need to. You don't even physically go to the campus anymore. You can just do it all through the internet. But I felt the same thing. I when I was a boy, I wanted to be a marine biologist because I enjoyed the killer whales, orcas. And I'll never forget. I asked the trainer at SeaWorld, "How long did you have to go to school?" And he said 8 years, and that was it. I walked away from that dream immediately. I let it go right there before I left the park. And that's the problem with college is you have to spend years studying things that you'll never use and that have no relevance towards your life passion and your dream. So,
yeah,
that's
where
my position is.
It's interesting. We've talked on my show in the past about this book called Disciplined Minds. It was written by a physicist named Jeff Schmidt, and he even talks about how a lot of the higher education programs for like the sciences and medicine are continuations of the subtle messaging of the public school system, where people are further made to, you know, be content existing in a kind of thinking box and not being too ambitious and not wanting to rock the boat so they can fit into the existing organizational structures in many of these different disciplines. And it's shocking because you think about some of those people, you'd like to think about some of those people in these cutting edge industries and explorations as being like trailblazers. But according to Jeff Schmidt in this book, that is not the case. So, yeah, I mean, like, what do you need to be? It seems very inefficient that someone would have to stay in school for 8 years to do almost anything. Like, when we think about how things work today and how information is available today. But you didn't go to college when you were 18, I assume. What did you do instead?
So, you know, out of high school, I went to one class. It was real estate principles. It was basically a real estate 101. I was interested. I went a year after, maybe a year and a half after I was already graduated high school. Right out of high school, I just started buying homes because I didn't know that that's what you're not supposed to do and you couldn't do that. So I just went ahead and did it. And I bought my second home with the real estate broker's commission in advance. She took a second trust deed. I took the commission and used it for my down payment before she had been paid the commission. And I just off I went. I just always was interested in wealth seminars. I loved going to Barnes & Noble. And, you know, for me, learning was when I got to go to Barnes & Noble's and read all these books that I wanted to read about money. And when I went to school, that was like just dead time for me. It was me wasting my time. I despised it. I wasn't learning what I wanted to learn. Occasionally in a history class or something, I might have my ears perked up. For the most part, all I cared about was, you know, girls and just getting back to home so I could either go on the internet and learn more about finance or go back to Barnes and Noble's and read. Mm. So, you know, I think one of the biggest disservices for college and schools is that they've trained people that learning comes from school. And, you know, it's the opposite. Learning comes from everywhere outside of the school. An education comes from outside school. Certainly you can learn and get an education from school, but it's just one place to get that information. There are many, many other places more than ever to get information.
Absolutely. I mean, learning comes from intrinsic motivation. You know, learning comes from curiosity driven by some sense of passion. And none of that for most people, that's very rare. It's not impossible, but it's very rare that they would find it in a school.
Absolutely. And you know, your teachers typically, they're not going to be able to connect with you because they have so many children in the classroom. You know, they've got 30 people who all learn, by the way, in different ways.
Yeah.
So you don't, you know, just because a child is underperforming, it doesn't mean they're underperforming because they're not smart. They might just not be learning how they need to learn. And that's the great thing about homeschool. My wife homeschools our three kids, and she was actually a former public school teacher for 7 years. And a lot of people think that, oh, that's why you can homeschool, because you were a public school teacher.
Right.
And she actually tells them it's the opposite. I had to unlearn everything I learned about becoming a public school teacher, because teaching your children homeschool is really a great privilege, because you can customize it to their education. So you, for example, we were able to teach my son to read rather quickly because he was able to read and focus on dinosaurs, which is his passion.
Mm-hmm.
And my daughter, my middle child, she just wants to learn. So she's picking everything up automatically. And then the third child, probably even ahead of the other two, because she's also just very interested in learning. So, you know, you can cater things to different children. And, you know, the main thing, though, with the public school versus homeschooling or your teachers, you know, it comes out so rude, but, you know, you don't know what the teacher's life experience is, and you don't know what their objective is. And essentially, this is a stranger around your children. And, you know, for me, when it came to financial success, and again, no disrespect, but I was not going to get anything from people making $30,000 to $40,000 a year who went to school for 4 to 6 years. Their objectives and their perception of life success was polar opposite of mine.
Absolutely. And it really wouldn't even be their salary that would, I think you'd agree with this too, wasn't even their salary that would push me away from wanting to look to them for any kind of mentoring. It most, like nine times out of 10, it was their attitude. You know, they weren't enthusiastic. They weren't passionate. I mean, I think I was going through high school at a time. Maybe I just had bad luck and like so many of the teachers were like nearing retirement and they were really burned out and they had been really drained by, you know, 30 years of frustration and ineffectiveness in that system. But yeah, I just found it like they were almost people who were sucking energy out of kids at the time when we needed it the most. You know, to like go out and attack the world.
Sure. And it's, you know, look, you've got a lot of great teachers out there. They're very passionate about their job, and thank God for them. But the fact of the matter is you've also got a lot of teachers that shouldn't be there because of the way the public school system is. Even the schools, they can't get rid of these people. And, you know, they're no doubt children are going to interact with those people. So, you know, one thing about homeschool is you can cater not only to the child, but you can cater the whole education system. You're obviously partnering them, your child up with people who are very passionate about their education. So look, and again, it's a privilege. I understand there's a lot of people listening to the show who can't do homeschool. Both people work. It's not in the schedule. Perhaps you're a single parent. So look, it's you can your child is going to ultimately do well because of your investment into them, whether they're public school or private school or homeschool. And I don't you know want anybody to have the you know impression that you have to homeschool your kid, because I totally understand that it's a privilege to be able to homeschool your kid.
Sure. It's unfortunate, but I agree with what you're saying. And I also like what your wife pointed out about, you know, having to unlearn what she knew as a teacher. One of the distinctions that I've been trying to make on my show for years now and spread this message around is that school is not education. The two are not even close synonyms. And I stopped using the phrase homeschooling, and I started using home education, because really I find only school can do school. And, you know, people set themselves up to not be successful even trying to, you know, maybe explore the possibility of education outside of the standard classroom when they associate what they have to do with schooling. Anybody can do home education, even if the kid has to be schooled 35 hours a week. You can undo some of that damage with home education and evenings and weekends and just, you know, being present and being interactive with kids. But, you know, what sounds like what you described to me is going on in your house, that sounds like home education. Like the only other animal that does school is fish. And it's when they all move together, you know, and in like predictable patterns. And, you know, education is rarely like that. It's people following their passions. It's lifelong. It's driven by, you know, intrinsic motivation and that curiosity. I think that's a really, really important distinction to make.
Sure. And when my kids get together with other homeschoolers, they will meet with, let's say, my 7-year-old. He'll meet there's 5-year-olds there. There's 10-year-olds there. There's 12-year-olds there. It's a more diverse group, just like you're going to experience once you're an adult, either running a business or working as an employee. You're going to be in a much more diverse group. Now, I will say this about the people who do decide to homeschool. What I have noticed is it is an exceptional group.
Yeah.
I would say that out of the, you know, 10 parents that I know just from being meetings, they all have a common theme. They're obviously they've all rejected the status quo. So right off the bat, your kids are interacting with a bunch of kids that all their parents reject the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
And then in that group, you're going to find the entrepreneurs, definitely a high percentage of entrepreneurs. You're going to find the free thinkers, the people who aren't stuck or sold on just one idea works, because obviously they've chosen an idea that's much different than the 90% of the population's the route they're going to go. So I actually I love that the kids are interacting with you know a high percentage of free thinkers and people who are not out of the box and are looking to do things, make their own path.
Absolutely. Well said. So let's rewind a little bit to you as a teenager, and you're just over 18 years old. You're investing in real estate in California, right?
Correct.
And what year are we talking? Because as I learned in the last decade, years are very important in real estate stories.
Absolutely. So I was buying in the year 2000. So little did I know, I was buying at the very, very beginning of a bull market that ultimately turned into a bubble. So in that sense, I got very lucky because let's say I turned 18 in 2006 or 2007.
Right.
My experience might be completely different with when it comes to real estate. Who knows? Maybe it would have even been better because I would have been able to buy all these properties at an extreme low. But it was in the early 2000s when I started buying in real estate, which of course led to the mistake in 2007, me confusing brains for a bubble. And I did have some, you know, foreclosures and some severe setbacks in 2007, 2008 when I got greedy. I tried, even though I was warning my friends and family and making videos on YouTube that there was a coming real estate crash, I was actually trying to flip as many homes as I could because I was trying to make as much money as I could before the whole thing imploded. So though I was right on the prediction of what was going to happen, I tried to squeeze in as many deals as I could. And because I thought I was smarter than I was, because I obviously bought in the 2000 and experienced nothing but success to that point.
Interesting. So what were you seeing through the real estate market around 2007 that motivated you to issue these warnings? And how did this, you know, unheard of website that had, you know, cats and salad fingers on it back then and not much more, how did that become the vehicle for issuing those warnings?
Well, you know, I was knocking on doors and going to the notice of default list. And first off, I noticed they were getting very large. The notice of default list that I would be able to go to and knock on these doors and try to connect with homeowners was large. There was less and less equity in these properties. And I noticed that they were all adjustable mortgages.
Right.
You know, and many of them vacant. A lot of them were non-owner occupied. So just being on the ground in Southern California, I knew there was a severe problem probably in 2006, very early 2007. I knew something was awfully wrong. I was also focused on the macroeconomic side. I knew what was going on with interest rates. I knew what was going on with subprime. And I knew the fact of the matter was that the entire real estate market at that point was built on air. You know, my wife, for example, was in college and she was an Applebee's waitress making $1,200 and we had just purchased three homes for her. And so I was part of it too. I had experience that I was like, okay, wow, they'll give money to anybody with a credit score because those were no doc loans. They literally ran your credit. You signed the bottom of the application, and it was done. You were approved for $200,000-$300,000. So I was aware that it was a bubble. That there was just it was ridiculous. And I would talk to people, and I knew people who should not be getting into these, you know, mortgages. They were getting these 1% mortgages where their payment was $2,000, and it just, you know, 5 years later. So I knew it was a bubble. And I started making the YouTube videos because essentially what happened was I was telling my father and my in-laws and my wife, and every day I was forwarding everybody emails. You've got to sell your stocks and you've got to sell all the real estate holdings that you can because this whole thing is going to implode. Nobody would really listen. And of course, my wife got tired of hearing it after a while. So I started a YouTube channel with a $20 webcam from Best Buy, and just started making videos that were unedited. And in those videos in early 2008, this is 9 months before Lehman Brothers, I am on the record as saying that Lehman Brothers, Washington Mutual, and AIG, Fannie and Freddie are all going to collapse and that the Dow Jones would go from 12,000 to under 8,000. And yeah. I not only predicted that, but I actually gave a time frame that this would all happen between the fall of 2008 and the spring of 2009. And that happens to be exactly when it happened. And when that happened, the YouTube channel got very large. Google somewhere in this time has taken over YouTube and made me one of their first YouTube partners. And I started making money from YouTube. And then ultimately, that led to the business that I run now.
Yeah, I remember that time, and we're gonna move into that in a minute. But I remember contemplating buying a house around that time, and I was just a teacher, You know, I think I made $35,000 a year. This was like 2004. And the people who ran this private school that I worked at, they liked the young and energetic types, and they wanted to kind of keep us in the town and not have us like move on to other careers. So they were encouraging us all to buy houses in the town. And, you know, I remember saying, I can't. One of the director of the school was even like, I'll help you go through the process. I'll make this happen for you. And I said, I make $35,000 a year. He said, you can buy any house in this town with that much money. It was, and this was a town in Vermont. And it didn't seem right to me, but I was so ignorant that I was almost seduced by the too good to be true. But apparently, if that's the way the whole school is moving, must be true kind of thinking. And I'm glad I managed to resist, because I think I could have been in a much worse situation. I think that it probably was hard to see that there were these sort of shadow banking arrangements, that people were going to make money on these failures for betting successfully that all of this would go wrong too, right?
Sure. Look, not very many people saw it. I mean, even the Federal Reserve was out there telling everybody that everything was fine, it was contained. And I noticed a lot of people that I spoke with, when I asked them what happened to when they went through a foreclosure or got into a payment, and almost all of them would always tell me, I felt like the bank wouldn't loan me more than I could afford.
Right. Isn't that something?
Yeah. They trusted the system. They trusted that the banker would put their interest first. And of course, this all goes back to there being zero financial education, unfortunately, for most people in their home.
Yep.
And definitely at the schools.
Yep.
There is no financial education. We spend more time on Greek mythology and a bunch of other things that have zero application in life. And you know what blows me away about the entire school system is financial education is going to determine 75-80% of the daily activities you do as an adult, and it could even ultimately determine your happiness or unhappiness. And there is zero time dedicated to financial education.
Oh, sure. Your health, the stability of your family, opportunities for your children. Absolutely. And one of the things that is taught in school is a kind of intellectual dependence. So people are very willing to put their – because they have no other choice. They don't have the financial education, as you mentioned, but they were also schooled in this idea of intellectual dependence on experts, right? Jim Cramer is the guy at the front of the room. He's got his sleeves rolled up like a teacher almost. He's got a chalkboard, I think. And those types of people, financial advisors, money managers, and bankers, like other, no one will let me make a mistake. So I really don't, like, I can trust my life to somebody because they seem to know more than me. Very, very dangerous kind of thinking.
It is. And, you know, as you know, most 96% of these people are not fiduciary advisors. So they're completely dependent on a commission check. They're completely dependent on you giving them their money. They don't work off performance. They're not performance based. They just, you know, are salespeople. And a lot of these people, by the way, when it comes to education for like a financial plan or something, someone who has to cut hair has to go through more of a process to get their license to cut hair than a person who does sell life insurance and 401ks.
Indeed. So a related question that is of interest to a lot of people in my audience right now, if the housing situation in 2007 and 2008 was a bubble, we are currently looking at a blimp in the form of student loans. But student loans are kind of different because there isn't actually any assets to take. And I don't know if that means it's more disastrous. Are you seeing a lot of similar indicators that you were trying to warn people about 10 years ago developing in this situation?
I think the student loan crisis and the college bubble itself is already having its effect. And it's more of a drawn out effect. It's kids or young adults living at home still to this day in their late 20s, early 30s. It's young adults not buying homes. It's young adults not being able to get the careers that they had wanted, or delaying marriages, delaying having children.
Sure.
You know, the Commerce Department's kept track of this data forever, and you could literally pinpoint down to when someone was going to get married, when someone was going to have a kid, and all that stuff is being delayed. All of it's being pushed back, and part of it is because of student loans. And I know so many people who, you know, they have, you know, such a tight budget because they've got an $800 a month student loan. And you know, it's kind of a competition. What's going to collapse first? The idea that college is mandatory, which I consider the college bubble, or the student loan bubble. And they're mutually dependent on each other. The student loans are able to continue to rack up because everybody thinks you need college. But at the same point in time, because the government is backing these student loans and basically giving teenagers blank checks and telling them not to make a payment until they graduate, all the universities are charging a ridiculous amount of money. Nothing has gone up faster than the price of inflation for college. And of course, if you look at that price inflation, when the government got involved in our college tuition, that's when the price inflation started to go up. And when they got more involved about 10 years ago, that's when it started to go parabolic.
Right.
And it's directly tied to the more government gets involved and the less the consumer has the feeling of the cost of their own behavior, which is a delayed payment plan, you know, we're just going to continue to see this rise. But, you know, look, a lot of people are already starting to wake up. Certainly the millennials, most of them have a lot of regrets about going to college, and they understand that, you know, they've wasted a lot of money. They waste a lot of time. So it's going to take a generation to cycle through. As far as defaults coming for student loans, that's already happening. And that's probably going to be happening in the auto sector as well, because the birth of auto subprime was born in 2009, and now that's over $1 trillion.
Yeah, I just looked at that chart. My goodness, it's terrifying. The change over the last decade or so, unbelievable.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this: all that being said, if you found yourself in an auditorium where you were sitting in front of, say, 1,000 high school students and their parents who were right on the cusp of making that college decision, and they need something better than college is not a wise investment anymore, how would you help them? I know it's hard to do this in a very general sense, but what would be some basic guidelines for the next 10 years of life that you would like to see more people doing instead of going the college route?
Well, I think they should ask themselves what they want to do, what they like to do. If it's a hobby that they can monetize, that's great for them. If there's a mentor or an apprentice that they could be to someone else who's doing something that they want to do, if there's something they can do or learn on the internet, but certainly offering free services to someone who's already doing what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Or undercharging somebody for a business that you're doing that you could do in order to essentially pay your tuition by either doing those services at a below market price or for free. You know, the idea of being a freelancer is the new economy. There is no work for one company for 30 years and get a pension. You know, the children, what they need to understand in the high school is that we have already transitioned into the freelance economy, and it's only going to get more so because of government regulations and new technological advancements and globalism's outsourcing. We are in the freelance economy, and it was sooner you understand that, the better. And guess what? To be an entrepreneur, to be a freelancer, it's easier than ever today. So I would suggest people, rather than just right off the bat go to college, first off, see if you really need to go to college. Mm-hmm. See if the person wants to go to college. And if they don't, there are 1,000 things that they can pick up from the internet. It's so easy to start a business. You can start a business in the matter of days. You could just start a website. Really, it's a matter of what that person wants to do. What do they see themselves doing? I think it's a mistake just to go to college. I think it's a mistake to go to college just because you don't know what you want to do.
Absolutely. So if somebody came to you and said, look, I have this passion project and I think it can be monetized, but it means all eggs in one basket kind of approach, would you encourage people to look for ways? This is a question I often ask myself, to diversify streams of income, especially in this emerging freelance economy. Is that latter route a better route to go if you can do it?
Multiple streams of income is always better. Yeah. I go all in with my active income. So I do not believe in diversifying your active income role. So a lot of entrepreneurs and successful people get distracted. They make a ton of money doing one thing, and then they want to just jump ship and go to another sector. Perhaps they want to start a restaurant or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they want, but what it does is it ends up tying them down. It's a waste of their time. Maybe they make some money from it, but they still make 90% of the money from whatever it is that they were good at. So for your active income, I suggest people go all in on whatever it is that you do. For your investments, multiple streams, diversify it. I buy first trust deeds. I buy real estate. I buy some stocks. I loan a lot of money out. I do whole life insurance. I mean, just I diversify streams of income.
Sure. Okay. So you're talking about it isn't from your experience, either in your own life or looking at the lives of others, it's kind of hectic and perhaps unmanageable to have multiple active income streams where you're changing directions to work on, you know, multiple disparate types of project. But income stream diversity is good if, you know, like maybe two additional streams could be passive. And passive doesn't just mean investment. Like you could, you know, bust ass for a month or two to get some kind of project started, a course you could sell, something like that, and then have that set up. And then that turns into a passive income stream. But of course, investing would be passive as well.
Yep, absolutely. I couldn't agree with that statement more.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. And when it comes to investing, is the goal – well, I guess, you know, the distinction I've heard you make in other interviews is income versus speculating. So can we talk a little – should the primary focus of investing be income?
Absolutely. Okay. If you're already rich – the yep. advantage of being rich is that you don't have to worry about bear markets or recessions because you're simply collecting checks. The problem with the middle class and anyone who's not rich, the mindset is that you're trying to get rich. And of course, that turns everybody into gamblers. People buy stocks. They have no idea what their investments are. They have no idea what the income is. Start keeping track of your income. How much money is coming back into your house? How much money is coming? How many checks are being written to you by these stocks you own? How much money? What's your cash flow? Focus on cash flow. Focus on income. The rest will follow. Now, speculation can be fun, and I like it as well. So about 10% of my wealth is focused on speculation, and it's real speculation. Rather than speculating that the Dow Jones is going to go up 7 or 8% a year,
right,
I'm trying to hit 10 grand slams, knowing that probably 7 or 8 of them will fail, but 2 of them may do really well, and those 2, I will make a significant amount of money. The rest of my portfolio, 90% of it, is simply focused on very boring investments, owning utility companies, owning a first trust deed, owning a whole life insurance policy, owning a single family house that I can collect the rent on. It's very boring investments. I'm not going to make a lot of capital appreciation, but at the end of the day, if you can get your multiple streams of income that are outside of your active income to pay off everything else that you do in life, like, for example, pay off your mortgage or pay your utility bills, you can start basic. Produce enough income to pay your DirecTV bill and then produce enough income to pay your electric bill. Keep collecting income and forget about this idea of capital appreciation that, you know, in 30, 40 years from now, you're going to have some nest egg that you can just draw off of. With that mindset, you're going to be miserable as a retiree anyway because you're always going to be taking meat off the cow. You're mm-hmm. far better off producing a dairy farm than a slaughterhouse.
Absolutely. Yeah, well said. We're about to run out of time, but can I ask you one more question about something I heard you mention a couple times? It's called Lending Club. So it's something that's good for people in your position who have money to lend, but also for a lot of people, who might be, you know, like I think about a lot of the young people in my audience might be in the other position where they need that startup capital to pursue some kind of a project. So I had never heard of Lending Club. Can we talk a little bit about what that is?
Sure. Lending Club is basically you're being the bank. And when I talk about Lending Club on our newsletter, I'm not talking about borrowing money from Lending Club. That is the consumer side of it. I am approaching it as the investor. So you are basically a credit card or personal loan lender. Mm-hmm. And Lending Club, it's the only publicly traded company that does peer-to-peer lending. And again, I don't recommend the stock. I'm only talking about it as an investor of making loans. Each loan can be as small as $25. So let's say somebody needs to borrow $10,000 to refinance some credit card debt. The Lending Club will approach the investors, and it's a pooled loan. So maybe out of a $10,000 consumer loan, your only stake in this is $25. And Lending Club goes through the process of running their credit. They make sure everybody has a credit score of over 660. Everybody has an average household income over $75,000 a year. And Lending Club is also in charge of collections. Now, there are, like any lender, there are going to be delinquencies. But if your commitment is $25, you know, divided by whatever $10,000 or even $1,000 that you put into this, your risk is very minimal. And you get a nice return of about 7-8% on a historical average. They've definitely increased their standards, because all of these peer-to-peer lending clubs, which really was a lending club in Pier Street before the 2008 crisis, the great thing about them is they had to go through hell to get on the other side because of the 2008-2009 credit crisis.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I think their quality of business is better than ever. Now, I can't mention Lending Club without also mentioning Pier Street. Now, Pier Street, they only want accredited investors. You know, it's you're buying first trust deeds at a minimum, same idea. It's $1,000 minimum investment on this one, but you can be part of an $800,000 mortgage. There's 30% equity in these properties, and you can get about a 7-9% interest rate. Now, accredited investor, it's an honor system. I'm just going to throw that out there. So technically, only accredited investors are supposed to be on there, but I highly recommend Pier Street.
Okay, good to know. And what do you see those types of operations doing to, you know, the banking establishment in the future? Are they too small at this point to even make any kind of a dent?
They're small, but they're disruptive. J.P. Morgan has already put $2 billion in with Lending Club. The mortgage market is definitely being disrupted by Pier Street. So this is going to be disruptive. It is going to be a new way people can opt out of Wall Street, opt out of the stock market for income. And guess what? This is exactly how the banks make money. So all you're not doing anything new. This type of lending has been around for 5,000 years. All you're doing is you're being the bank. You know, rather than buy JP Morgan stock on Wall Street and watch them make money from loaning money, you're simply loaning the money and the payments are made to you.
Very interesting. All right. Well, we can leave it there for today. I really appreciate your time and you sharing your story with us. I'm trying to get as many of these stories of people who, for whatever reason, just at that, you know, that crucial age, they had it, you know. And I don't know if you think it was coming across the right books or just having the right motivations or attributing it to something else. And if it is something else, you can certainly share. But it didn't sound like you had a really active mentor through that process, and you encountered a lot of friction along the way. But by the time you were 18 years old, you were on a completely different path from the one that was prescribed. And I always think that makes such an interesting story that I want people in my audience to hear.
Yeah, I mean, bottom line, it comes down to not being – I never liked being told what to do. And I was always fearful of having and being stuck somewhere doing something I didn't want to do. But I mean, bottom line – you know, for anybody, no matter what you do, if you're listening to the show, the equation for financial independence or making money is very simple. You simply deliver value to other people. That's it. And the more people you can deliver value to, the more money you'll make.
Absolutely. So if people in my audience want to learn more about your work, where can they find you?
Please go to futuremoneytrends.com. You can subscribe free to our weekly wealth digest, and from there you'll receive cash flow ideas, income ideas, and we also do speculative ideas. But futuremoneytrends.com, and if you want to reach out to me, just hit the contact us page.
Yes, and you still have this now like ancient YouTube channel, right? We're talking set up 10 years ago, and it's still active. You're posting every week pretty much, right?
Yeah, I pretty much post all the videos on Future Money Trends' YouTube channel now, but you're right. There is the Vision Victory channel that's still out there. You can still see the archive videos. I think occasionally we do probably a Future Money Trends re-upload on Vision Victory, but for the most part, Future Money Trends, the YouTube channel, is where we do all of our new videos.
Awesome. Well, Dan, thank you so much for your time and for the information and, again, for sharing your story. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Brett.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all went to the university, and they all got put in boxes, little boxes, all the same.